You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Take one. Knock, knock.
It is. Receiving a Dana, and we can't believe you found a fucking podcast.
A podcast.
We're so glad you're listening to it. We would never listen to it.
I don't even want to listen to it to edit it.
I don't even want to wake up in the morning. Stephen and Dana, and we're in the room.
Take it again from the top.
No, not from the top. Anything but the top. Oh, there's an eyelash on this table. That's a girl who's had extensions, and they just keep falling out. You can ask me because I have them, and there's eyelashes all over my apartment.
This office is a pigsty.
I know. We are at...
You guys, hi from Time Out New York.
Hello. We are atop the floor.
Tallest building in Midtown.
We're on a floor that's 42nd.
I didn't know they went that high.
42nd floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels glamorous every day.
You guys were with Adam Feldman.
Hi.
Ooh. We're so excited.
It's a very fancy office.
Very fancy. There was free hand sanitizer.
There's so many desks.
There was candy canes.
Wait, you didn't pay for the hand sanitizer?
There was no receptionist.
All right. Well,
so
it's not
my fault that we're here after hours.
Oh.
Your therapist has the same water bubbler system.
Isn't that fun?
So fun. So New York.
I've already refilled my water bottle in that once today, and I will be refilling it a second time.
You got a free Sunkist out of this?
That's true. We were talking earlier about our mutual, our shared affection of Sunkist orange soda.
And like, not soda all the time for me, but when I want one, it's a Sunkist or a DDP, which is also your go-to.
Dr. Pepper, my other caffeinated soda drink go-to.
And I'm the trash person with the sugar-free Red Bull.
Well, cheers.
Cheers. Okay, slurping break.
Mm. What are those videos where they're
ASMR, great? ASMR, yeah. ASMR. Yeah. It's my favorite.
It's my favorite thing.
It's how I fall asleep.
Just.
I know.
Yes, soda
that's
can.
Exactly it.
Refreshing.
ASMR at Time Out New York. Anyway, so where did we leave off? What have we done in the past week since
our fabulous Disney Plus has dropped?
Disney Plus. I've got the free week trial.
You got that week on.
I got that week on. So we're like heavily steeped in watching Encore Exclamation Point. You guys, this is a Red Bull, and I'm already just like three sheets.
This is going to be a happy
three sheets.
You guys.
Exclamation
it's
point.
Monday.
Encore, it's so good.
It's the greatest.
Oh, it's so good.
Adam Feldman, have you watched Encore on Disney Plus at all?
I have not. I don't have Disney Plus.
Yeah.
You're both judging me right now. You're looking at me with this.
I can't hide it.
Angry,
disappointed
eyes. Well,
no, of all
eyes.
The streaming services, I do get the reluctance because, like, you know what's on it. You're going to run out of content to watch.
Yeah.
I guess. Okay. I just feel like there's so much that I haven't yet seen on HBO and Netflix, both of which I have, and I don't really feel an urgent need to get another one right now. But maybe one day I will. I'll run out of
the Here's the programming options. Specificity about Disney Plus. It has a show called Encore! Exclamation Point. Hosted, I think, created maybe by...
Executive produced by...
Kristen Bell.
High school musical cast reading.
Yes.
Yeah. I almost submitted for that.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the musical?
It was Into the Woods. And it was great. I have amazing video of it. It's the best thing we did in high school. It wasn't actually done in my high school. It was done in my local community youth theater, the Shar HaShemayim Players.
God bless you.
Which is like a synagogue youth group.
God bless you.
In Montreal. But the problem is that a lot of the cast members are still in Canada, and we wouldn't have been able to get them here.
Oh, damn it.
It's a real shame because it was special.
I believe you.
Yeah.
I think they cast it really well. I'm sure they had a lot of submissions, but they made sure that those characters have something going on and are fully prepared to put their heart out there. I mean, it is delightful. It's hilarious.
It's so good.
It's really endearing.
It's just long enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've known two
really
people
good.
Who are on it.
Yeah.
Which is thrilling. Carmel Dean was musical director.
Past guest of this podcast.
Past guest.
She's Adam Mochter. I hope to be future guest of this podcast.
Yes, we've known the musical directors. And then Rob Meff on the Annie episode.
Well, the baker in our Into the Woods is Seth Abramovich, who's now a big-time, big-shot reporter for The Hollywood Reporter. So we both went into entertainment journalism. That would have been a fun little sub-story.
Yes!
I still haven't given up the dream. Maybe one day we can do it.
You're very, I'm going to work best worst thing that ever could have happened into this episode. You're like, where did your success take you and what do you define success as?
Deep.
Yeah,
we'll
so.
We'll get to that, but people don't even know who I am yet.
I love it. They probably won't at the end of this episode.
Yeah, I don't know who I am. I can't expect it of anyone else.
That's common knowledge.
Well, here's how we're going to introduce you. Listeners, are you ready? Last weekend, Stephen and I were fortunate enough, because we're part of the newly formed Broadway Podcast Network, we were invited by Ken Davenport from The Producer's Perspective, a big-time theater producer and creator and teacher, to come to his super conference. I think it was the third annual. It's a full weekend. And it's creators, producers, performers, agents, directors. I mean, people who want to create in the business, theater makers, who want to collaborate and do this. And you were part of the critics panel. And
yes.
It was thrilling, Adam Feldman.
Thrilling.
Thrilling. Wow. Okay, so you are the theater editor and theater critic for Time Out New York.
That is correct.
Which is
we
really
have
cool.
Other theater critics. There are freelancers who write for us. Technically, I'm the national theater and dance editor for Time Out.
Wow. So it's not just super local New York?
It's mostly New York, but I do edit the reviews that we run in Chicago, and sometimes I'll take a look at... There are other publications that come out on a less regular basis elsewhere in the country, and so I'll do some work for those ones.
So you brought up freelancers, who I care deeply about. How
deeply.
How many people is that for you?
It depends.
And how
I
do
mean,
you become a freelancer
for
Time
Out? Are a few that we use on a regular basis. For a long time, my sort of number two here was Helen Shaw, the great Helen Shaw.
Yes.
And she has actually worked at Time Out or in association with Time Out for 14 years. But she just got the critic position at New York Magazine, so she won't be able to do it for us anymore, which I'm very sad about because she's wonderful. But happily, I have many other critics whom I also like very much and who are very good at what they do. And so I'm not feeling it too keenly. But I will just miss her because I love her.
Yeah.
But yes, we have a few that write for us on a fairly regular basis and with whom I have an ongoing, comfortable working relationship. But I am always on the lookout for new writers. And so if anyone out there wants to send me some clips and things like that, then I will take a look at them. Can't guarantee that anything will come of it, but I'm always happy to take a look.
Use promo code in the room.
Well, I mean, speaking of that, you could say that. Like, I heard you mention this kind of way of submitting stuff.
Sure.
How do they find you? How do they submit?
It's very easy. It's just my email is adam.feldman@timeout.com. And they can just write to me there.
You've heard it here, folks. I think we've heard enough, actually.
What a cool email address. at timeout.com.
That's right.
Cut it out. Okay, so Super Conference was incredible, and we really got our butts on fire with the critics panel. That was a really fun discussion, was it not?
It was fun. It's
it got fiery and...
Well, it got a little extra fiery because instead of... There were three of us on the panel, mm-hmm. Plus a moderator, but one of the panelists who had been scheduled to attend, Chris Jones from the Chicago Tribune, and who also writes for the Daily News now, was unable to attend. And so at the last minute, they switched him out with Michael Riedel, the New York Post gossip theater columnist. He's not really a critic, and he wouldn't call himself one. But he has written critically about things, and he certainly knows what the score is. He's been covering critics for many years. And so that added a level of spice to the discussion, as it always does when Michael is involved.
Well, as critics, I mean, you have your voice in print, so it's fun to see critics in person to yeah. put a face to the print. And you know, you had wildly different personalities up there. I mean, as you can tell, listeners, Adam Feldman has, you know, dulcet tones.
That's
and
what
very
I was gonna say.
Yeah, very like calm, and I feel safe. I feel safe. Very, you know, like evening cocktails with Adam Feldman kind of vibe. And then you have Michael Riedel up there, who is just like, well, and then this is what I thought. And I'm like, yes, like this is what we came up. Like, I loved it. I thought it was really great.
And Lisa Gardner, who's lovely,
and she was right in the middle. Just like, she had yet another kind of...
She is also on the Broadway Podcast Network.
Yes, she is. And she had a different point of view. So it was really exciting to watch you guys go back and forth.
Well, that's my favorite type of group of critics, is when we do have differences of opinion. It makes it much more interesting. It's one of the main functions, I think, that we fulfill if the system is working correctly. Mm-hmm. And one criticism that Michael had, actually, was that there's too much... agreement within the critical community these days for his taste. There aren't enough contrarians. I'm not sure that that's true, but I would agree that the more voices... I'm not saying you should like something or dislike something just for the sake of being different from everybody else, but mm-hmm. it would be nice if there were a large enough system that multiple responses were more easily accessed. Because I think that makes, you know, it adds to the chord. It makes it a richer sound, mm-hmm. you know. It gives it more complexity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, I mean, whatever. I often disagree with what most people seem to think about shows. I mean, but I often agree, too. But ultimately, I think that reflects the quality of the shows. So a lot of the time, there are shows that work and there are shows that don't. And I think, as critics, most of us are going to have a similar response from most people seeing those shows, which is this works or this doesn't. And then sometimes there will be differences of taste, or there will be things about it that you are particularly taken with based on your own critical perspective or experience. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, I think it settles into a consensus. There are a few shows that are very divisive, but most of them are not. It's true. So ultimately, I mean, partly when you're looking for the critic that you enjoy reading, a lot of it will be someone that you trust, but it also will be someone that you enjoy reading. And so trying to write well becomes a big part of the job, trying to make the review entertaining in and of itself as a piece of writing.
Who were those critics for you as you were making your own name in the business and becoming a critic yourself? Who did you find yourself agreeing with or going to first to read?
Well, Frank Rich was an early role model. I was, oh boy. I mean, I got into this in a weird way, but I did a lot of theater when I was a kid, and I was really into theater. So, and I was into musical theater, and I had all these cast albums, and I would buy them on CD, and I would listen to them. You know, and
I'm going to stop you right there. CD?
Yeah, it's.
Can you tell our listeners what a
compact,
it's like a little
disc.
Frisbee that you put into a machine?
Ah, frisbees,
and it
yes.
plays music. So I loved these shows, and I was also a big geek, and so I wanted to have conversations about these shows, but most of the kids my age were not as interested in these shows as I was. And so I would go to the library, and I would look up reviews from at the library. I mentioned this on the critics panel, but it's true. I would go to the Coates St. Luke Library, and I would get the New York Times microfiche, and I would, you know, find the, you know, what did they say about Evita, or whatever, you know, what did Jack Kroll in Newsweek yeah. say about Evita, you know? And so I had a lot of those, and sometimes they would be very surprising to me, because they, you know, critics are giving, like all journalists, you were giving a first draft of history, or in this case, a first draft of artistic evaluation, and sometimes people get it wrong. I've seen it happen in the time that I've been a critic. I'm sure there have been times when I've been wrong about things. there are some that I can point to. I won't. But, you know, I like to think that I mean, I do the best I can.
That's
to be
interesting
there.
To have your taste shift with time. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, or not necessarily your taste, but your appreciation for the thing in question. You know, there are things that sometimes you don't really get, or you don't value the things about them that are great, because there are other things in them that aren't great, and you weigh it out the wrong way. Because most things, there are good things and bad things, you know? So it's about forgiving the things that aren't 100% because the things that are good in it are worthwhile, are especially new or interesting. Or and sometimes when you've got works that are ambitious, there's a greater likelihood of that happening. It's not just trying to do one thing and either, you know, is this jukebox musical successfully telling the story of the, you know, Temptations or whatever? That's one question. And then there are shows that are much more, that have higher aspirations and take bigger risks. And sometimes those risks don't pay off. And if you just see the ones that don't pay off, or you weigh them out wrong, then you can end up coming to the wrong conclusion, I think, about the show. And that certainly happened with me on a number of occasions. I will look back at a review that I wrote, and I will think, you know, it's not that I disagree with the review. It's that I think I didn't structure it right. I ended with the negative part. You know, it ended up being like, even though good thing X, bad thing Y, instead of being even though bad thing Y, ultimately good thing X.
Sure.
And a lot of shows, it's interesting to me which shows stay with me. And, you know, years later, I will think back to certain shows that I wasn't 100% sold on, and I will think about them with interest and fondness, and then other shows that I remember having liked, you know, where there's documented proof that I liked it somewhere,
sure.
But that turned out to make no impression, and that just worked sort of in and out. I see a lot of shows a year, so that's unusual. I see hundreds of shows a year, and so there's a greater likelihood of things going in and out. I know that, but it is sometimes surprising to me what stays and what doesn't.
Michael Riedel had, I think he's the one that mentioned this, but it's also within the historical context of what is happening when these musicals are being put on. So,
absolutely, yes. And in a lot of ways, there's, you know, well, sometimes this is true of comedies. You know, we'll look at something now and we'll think, oh, God, that's so unfunny. But it was, that we're wrong. It was
right,
funny.
Right.
It was funny to someone.
I howled at Home Improvement.
I mean, right.
Howled.
It's just that those things, and then when something is successful comedically, other things become imitative of it, and then it becomes a cliche.
Derivative.
And it becomes corny. And then you see the original one, and it just seems like all these other things that you've seen. And, you know, so that's part of it, too. But a lot, especially in comedy, there's a lot of where surprise and freshness are a big part of the recipe. But it's also true sometimes about conversations that people are having at that moment, and what sort of taps into the zeitgeist in a certain way, and what might be slightly ahead of its time. Chicago is a good example of that. Chicago did fine on Broadway, but it was eclipsed by the success of A Chorus Line, and then you know 20 years later it comes back, and in the wake of the O.J. Simpson trial, and everyone is suddenly really getting Chicago in
it's
a way
still
that
they happening.
Didn't. Yeah,
it is still happening.
It's
right.
still happening,
and it's still on. Now it's the most successful, longest running American musical of all time.
Isn't Erica Jane coming into it?
Who knows?
I can't
keep up.
But and then they also did that. They're doing that really well. I mean, come on.
Well, I mean,
if people slip in and out of that,
yeah,
all the
and
time.
There's a meta level to that too, the
sure.
show business aspect of it. But one that I often come to is I often use this as an example. I have for years because it's one of my favorite shows, but it is Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tesori's *Caroline or Change*, which is, for my money, one of the very best musicals of the last 50 years, and a musical that I can honestly say, and I can say this about very few shows, that I feel like it has actually changed my life on a daily basis. Like, it's changed how I interact with the world.
Wow.
And
I don't know it.
Oh, it's great. Well, it's coming back this spring, so you have a chance to see it. And I'm sort of all sort of nervous and excited because I'm so emotionally attached to the show that it makes me a little bit nervous. I spent 15 years talking about how good the show is.
Yeah.
I want the
Have you ever reviewed it?
To be good. I reviewed it when it was at the Public. I reviewed it again when it was at on Broadway. I reviewed the cast album, and I reviewed a production of it off Broadway in Astoria last year. So I Yes, I review it every chance I get because
with our girl LaDonna Burns.
LaDonna Burns.
Yeah, with LaDonna Burns. But there is a show that did not get the critical respect that it deserves. A few of us really went to bat hard for it, and I can count them on one hand. I still remember who it was because I was so angry with the critics that I didn't think got it. Because mm-hmm. It's the kind of show that you have to trust because almost everything in it happens in the second act. And if you check out in the first act, then you won't get it. And you have to be willing to go with it. You have to sort of know that in advance. It wasn't written to have an intermission. They just sort of put an intermission in, and it's not structured that way. It doesn't have that sort of throw into intermission that, uh-huh. that musicals usually have. You could sense that. You could also sense at the time, this is where the timing comes in, you could sense that there was a bit of a backlash against Tony Kushner. Because everyone had loved Angels in America, and then everyone, you know, How Many Cobb would come, and people were sort of less sold on it, but they still were behind it. And then this weather comes along, and it becomes the moment in the narrative when it's like, oh, was he ever really that great? You know, there's this. No one does it consciously, but there's sort of that moment in the flow of a career mm-hmm. where people were ready to turn on him somehow, and did not appreciate how great. The show is. Also, here's another different kind of timing. The show, because Tony Kushner is astonishingly alert in an almost prophetic way to undercurrents of culture that are about to erupt. So
that was a sentence. Oh my God.
But no,
You're a professional.
But because he is, this show. You know, this is a show that was about people tearing down Confederate statues. This is a show that is about white privilege. This is a show that's about economic disparity and socioeconomic difference and the impossibility of having real relationships in the, you know, the difficulty of having real relationships. And also the difficulty of acting courageously when you are economically disadvantaged. And all of these things have become much bigger parts of the common discourse in the past 10 years. But in 2003, they were not yet there. This show was ahead of its time in that way. And I think that now it'll be interesting to see how people respond to it. Also, it got great reviews everywhere else it played after New York because the cast album was out and the script was out and the good reviews were out. And people could read them, and people could listen to them, and people knew the show a lot better than the people who were just seeing it at the first pass. I'm not blaming those people for not having the right response to it. It was a lot to take in, and that first group of people, a lot of them, I think, just missed it.
Beautifully put.
I can't wait to see it.
Put. Yeah, I was actually thinking, because I got tickets for it, because... dying to see it. Yeah. And I don't remember the last time I bought tickets that far in advance for anything.
Yeah. Well, it's a limited run, and in my little hopey dreamy place, there's part of me that fantasizes that it will find a larger audience and will extend and will become the hit that it deserved to be in 2003. It was also, speaking of timing, overshadowed that year by other shows. It was overshadowed by Wicked, which was the same year, and Avenue Q, which was the same year, and The Boy from Oz. And it didn't have Oxygen.
Yeah, you got to take into consideration the season, even. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, then that happens a lot. Sometimes it's just a luck or lack of luck of the draw in terms of when you're up, and when there are years where you look at the best musical winner for the Tony Award and you think, boy, that's not really a great show. But then you look at what else was available and you think, oh, well, best of a bad lot.
Checks out. Should we go from where you were born? You're a Canadian.
I am. Yeah. Yo soy canadiense.
How'd that happen?
I was born and raised in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And it's a great town that everyone should visit. I feel like people don't take advantage of it as much as they should.
It's close enough.
It really is. The exchange rate's really favorable right now for American dollars. You can eat really well there. You can shop really well there. It's full of beautiful people. It's kind of a sexy town. It's an old, by North American standards, city. So you have, you know, buildings in it that date back hundreds of years. And it has a real... Because it's mostly French, it has a real sense of differentness from being in the United States. And so it has the feeling of being of going on like a European vacation, except it's only an hour away by plane, and it's much cheaper. So everyone should go all the time. I still go back. I have family there, and I still go back a couple times a year. And I always feel so lucky that I got to grow up there. It's also Canada is full of nice people.
Obviously, you speak French.
I socialize medicine. Also, yeah, and also I learned French from a young age, which is handy. I don't.
You're so cool.
Well, I don't speak it very. My first language is English. But I did learn French. I learned French in school before I learned English, and I took a lot of classes in French by choice because I wanted to have a better grounding in bilingualism. I don't participate that much in some kind of expat French world here, so I don't get to use it very much. But there is something about the experience of learning two languages early, I think, that gives you a bit of a useful sense of complexity in the world. You start being slightly alert to the ways that things can be said or can't be said in different languages. It makes you think a little bit more, maybe, about those questions, about communication, about how the words that are available to us can subtly shape our ideas, or how they subtly reflect our ideas. So that was all useful for me. I also learned Hebrew when I was a kid because I went to a Jewish day school. So I learned that until I was 12, and then I took little bits. I took 2 years of Spanish in high school and 1 year of German. It's hard to explain, but in Quebec, you go up to grade 11, and then there's 2 years of this sort of in between thing called CEGEP. And I did 1 year of that before I went to college here.
Can you call me the most beautiful person you've ever seen in another language?
Tu es la plus belle personne que j'ai jamais vue.
Well, she's straight, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh my god! I'm gonna cry. That's beautiful. Aww. And so you grew up there, and then...
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you feel that you could review something in French?
No, I wouldn't trust myself to do it. I can get by in French, and when I'm at a bar or something and I meet someone French, I like to practice as much as I can, but I know the difference, and it's frustrating for me in French because I take English language very seriously. I was an English major in college, and it's what I do for a living, is evaluate the use of language a lot of the time, and I'm acutely aware of my own deficiencies in French. I know that I cannot express myself as well as I'd like to. I also know that I'm not taking in the nuances of the language in the same way that I would in English. I might be able to understand it, but I won't be getting all the different resonances of it. And I wouldn't trust myself to be an expert in evaluating such a thing. Whereas I've spent a lot of time cultivating a knowledge of English. And I'm very verbal. It's all I do. Like I play a lot of crosswords. that's what I do. I'm addicted to this word game, this terrible word game on Facebook. It's awful. I lure friends into it, and then I demolish them.
What is it called?
It's called Word Blitz. Oh God, it's
no,
basically
Adam.
Boggle, but with Scrabble tiles and scoring. So. You play for a minute. It's very, very, very fast, and you just find as many words as you can. And it's not. I can't really in good faith.
Is this your deepest, darkest secret? your oh, face God. Tells me it is.
It feels so good.
Is this a cult?
It feels so good to talk about it. Finally. No, I mean it's just it's not a good use of my time.
Listen, I just started a game where you have to like cook hamburgers and put lettuce and tomatoes on a thing and like get it out to the people who ordered it. That's the game.
But this isn't smart. I mean, it helps to know a lot of words and stuff, but this is a speed game. This, at a certain point, at a certain level, I've become very... I'm not bragging here. Like, I honestly, it's a fact. I've become very good at this game. I'm one of the best people at this game on Facebook.
It's a fact.
They have level play, and I'm at the level above level one.
Wow.
Because I've played that much. Like, I've wasted that much
you
time.
Have a black
That's
belt
why you should be on this
play.
Podcast.
I have a black belt in this. But the thing is, like, in order to play, I have to trick friends into playing, and then it's no fun at all to play with me because I've gotten quite good at it, and there's no way that they can have a good game.
It's kind of sick of you.
Yeah,
I used to play a game with family and friends on Facebook called Farmville and or Frontierville, And I got my mom into it, and she got so into it that she created another Facebook account for herself so that she could, like, help her own farm.
Wow.
Back and forth.
She's like cat farming herself.
Can you tell the listeners what her fake Facebook name was?
It was Efazin Frank, because our last name is Farazee, and when you're on the phone, you say Efazin Frank.
Like I do too.
So it was Efazin.
Efazin.
It's nice that that's universal, because I do also Efazin Frank, ELD, as in Daniel, and as in Mary A.N.
You know why I think you're so iconic? Talk about transitions.
Yeah, sure.
So you are, I've known you for many, many, many years as Adam Feldman, the theater critic. But you're also not just Broadway or off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway in Astoria. You are, your fingerprint is all over New York City, including cabarets, drag performances.
Yeah,
like, you're all over.
When I started at Time Out in 2003, there was a cabaret subsection. There was a small cabaret section, and they eliminated that section, folded it into the music section.
God damn
And asked me if I wanted to do it. And I did. I was going to cabarets. I liked it. And so I just sort of absorbed that into my duties. And I've done that with a bunch of other things since. But I love cabaret. I think it's one of those things that we don't take advantage of enough in the city. It's not unique to New York, but it is almost unique to New York. And certainly on the scale that it happened. I mean, there are multiple clubs that focused exclusively on cabaret performance in New York City. That's not true of other places in the world.
And I feel there was a boom, like, I would say 10-ish years ago, that like cultivated the careers of people who are just like now making it, right?
And there was an alt cabaret boom. And I was in the middle of that when it was happening, because it involved a lot of downtown people and a lot of theater people, or people who were just sort of doing this in-between space. And things like Our Hit Parade at Joe's Pub, series like that. The cabaret world was changing generally, because it had been this kind of rarefied hotel room, expensive genre. You know, a lady in a dress singing Cole Porter at the Algonquin. And I love that, so I was happy to see that. But the audience for that was diminishing every year.
Dying?
Diminishing
passing?
Every year.
Okay, diminishing.
We're not going out as much.
Sure.
And also a lot of those, at that time, there were still a lot of great stars who were still alive who had been doing that during the years when that music was pop music. And so there were people that you could see, like Rosemary Clooney or Eartha Kitt, who were still performing in the clubs. And that's not really the case anymore. You still have one or two, like Marilyn May, but for the most part, we've passed out of that generation, and now it's people who love this music and want to honor it, but don't have that deeper sense of in the bones connection to it, to the music that some of these older performers had. And also, the music itself it gets farther and farther from us every year, you know. So at a certain point, it tips over and it starts sounding to younger people like operetta sounds to me, you know. And I don't really like thinking about that, because there so many of these songs seem to me so timeless and still so perfect and beautifully crafted, and I think they still have a lot to say to us, but the tastes are shifting. And so what we've seen with that is a shift even in cabaret, which is mostly covers of existing material. But we've seen a shift, and it's been noticeable over the past 20 years, toward more recent chapters of the Great American or Great British Songbook. And so we're seeing people doing covers of pop music from the 1960s, which doesn't sound like pop music from the 1940s. You have shows devoted to the Beatles or to Bob Dylan or Sting, you know. It's a long discussion, but it's been
interesting. And cabaret is so broad. I mean, cabaret can include comedians. It can include,
drag performance, dance performance.
Exactly. And there's something about, it lives in a place where, sure, these people can be on Broadway if they'd like, but it lives in a category off of that, where it's between pop music and Broadway. It's like their own, they're channeling their own monster in a very like kind of Bette Midler way, where it's like everything. Sure. Like, I'm going to do some stand-up. I'm going to sing an opera song. I'm going to sing pop music. I'm going to do the Carpenters. I'm going to do XYZ. And I'm like, that is so exciting.
And And also, it's a great way. So if you go to places like Feinstein's 54 Below, you will often get to see really talented Broadway stars or up-and-coming, you know, musical theater people. Mm-hmm. And you're getting to see them in a showcase that they never will be able to do on Broadway.
Yes.
A showcase of their versatility, of their range, of their personality. They will, on Broadway, even in the biggest part, you know, even if you're watching someone do Mama Rose, mm-hmm. you are still watching them in another person's track, you know, mm-hmm. in a track that's been written for them, only doing a certain kind of song. And here they get to show off whatever they want. So if you get to see Patti LuPone in 54 Below or whatever, and you're going to be in a small room with 120 other people.
It's terrifying. It's amazing. It's so thrilling.
It's astonishing. It's astonishing. Yeah. And it costs the same or less than going to a Broadway show and sitting in an audience of 1,500 people. Yeah. So, I don't understand why people don't go to Montreal twice a year, I don't understand why people don't go to Cabaret all the time. It is. There's so much.
I try my damnedest, Adam. I try my damnedest.
And I started singing also again. That's a long story.
Tell us all about it.
I've been singing a lot more. I used to sing when I was a kid, and then I kind of stopped. I'll give you the short version of this story.
Okay.
It's a good story.
Yeah,
but
I'm into it.
It'll be the subject of my second cabaret show. It shouldn't be my first one, but it'll be nice when I put together a cabaret show.
Have you done your first?
I did do one. I threw together one a few years ago, which I've been meaning to do again or to do a modified version of again. But it was just like a one-time thing at Sid Gold's.
Sid Gold's.
Yeah. But no, that was really fun. I learned a lot from it, I gotta say.
Sure.
Learned a lot from it. This was very instructive. But basically about 10 years ago, I lost my voice. Like, I really lost my voice. Like, I couldn't make any sounds with my voice. And it was a gradual process. I thought it was just sort of the weather, and I had recently gone through a breakup, and I thought it was just, you know, I didn't really notice it creeping in until it was, not deniable. And so I went to the doctor and ran a battery of tests, and it turned out I had this very rare vocal cord disease. And so it was these growths on my vocal cords that we would cut off. Not cancer, but just these recurring growths that would be
like
cut
hemorrhoids
off
of the vocal cords.
Thank you. I prefer not to think about it that way. Okay. But yeah, I would have surgery and we would cut them off and then they would grow back. And, so this went on and on. It was really scary. Because I legitimately didn't know if I'd ever be able to talk again, much less sing. And I had 11 surgeries in a year and a half, seven under general anesthetic. And at a certain point, I was in this experimental drug trial in Boston, and I was going every 6 weeks to go under the knife. And what happened during that time is that there would be a little window in the middle of that 6 weeks. And a window where my throat had recovered enough from the surgery to make a few sounds and had not yet gotten sick enough again not to make those sounds. And I would be able to croak out a few notes, nothing pretty and nothing rangy, but I was really happy to be able to do it. And I started going out to to piano bars and singing because I was just so grateful to be able to make these sounds. And that really changed my relationship to singing, because when I was a kid, I was a really good singer. I could just sort of go really high, and I could do like Jesus Christ Superstar screech range stuff. And I realized in retrospect that it was really pretty boring for other people because it was very show-offy. You know, it wasn't really connected to the material. It was just my voice could do anything and go anywhere, and I would just be like, hey, look how awesome this is. And it wasn't, I realized in retrospect, it wasn't that interesting to other people, and it also ended up being not that interesting to me. I didn't go into it as a profession, and I stopped doing it on a regular basis. I would do it at karaoke sometimes, but it wasn't something I did regularly. And when I had this experience of losing it, and this experience of trying to sell a song with four croaking notes, and connecting to it in that way, that permanently changed my relationship to singing. And then miraculously, I got better. I hope it never comes back. You know, it's always every time I get a sore throat, I worry. But it just, after the last surgery, it just never came back. Mm. No one knows why. Doctors don't know why. Idiopathic.
It was because it was like, you better get your ass up on a stage and think about singing again.
It was a sign. It was a sign from the doctor. But yeah, so
that's so cool.
So I kept on singing. I would go to piano bars all the time. I used to be at the Duplex all the time, and now I've sung in a bunch of shows when people invite me at, you know, Joe's Pub and 54 and other places like that.
Club Cumming.
I'm there every Monday night. Lance Horn, who's a great pianist and songwriter, he plays piano and hosts this Monday night open mic night at Club Cumming every Monday, and I am there every Monday. We are taping this on a Monday. I will be there later tonight. Come rain,
I knew
come shine.
That's where you were going. It's true. I still haven't been there on a Monday night. I usually go to the Wednesday Cabernet.
Well, which is great, which I love.
Yeah,
but this is a very different thing. This is an open mic night.
Yeah,
and it's an open mic.
I'd love to
show tune, show tune geek night, but it's. It's different from any that I have experienced. I've been to a lot of those. It has a different vibe. It has a real center, sort of a core community of regulars who are there every week, who often will prepare something really unusual, either some deep cut of a musical, or they'll bring a costume, or they'll put together a little number.
People just try and shit,
just throwing stuff against the wall. Cool. And it's fun. Sometimes people talk through it, and sometimes they listen. It's interesting to see, you know, like it is always in those scenarios. But and again, kind of more of a downtown feel to it than you often get at open mics of this nature. It's sort of a little sexier sometimes. You know, there's usually some shirtlessness at some point in the night. It's great fun, and it's become a lovely community for me.
Let's go on a Monday sometime.
No, I know. It's on the top of my list of things to do.
Great.
I can't recommend it highly enough. I love it. Anyway, so that was a long digression into my vocal history.
No, that was short and sweet. That was great. I love that story.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Obviously, you love theater. That's where your passion is. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that you are a critic of theater and not film and television.
Right.
Has that ever interested you? Have you ever tried to, just to, like, as an exercise?
I've written occasionally over the years that I've been here. I've written film and television reviews or book reviews when there was something that was related to my field of interest, or, you know,
like a movie, musical,
fun.
I have done. I've reviewed a few of those live TV musicals that they were doing. Last week, I wrote something quite negative about the new song that Taylor Swift has written with Andrew Lloyd Webber for Cats, which was
I
did not mince words, and I'll tell you, there was you will be surprised to hear that social media was not entirely happy.
Speaking
with
of
my
backlash,
review, my notifications were on fire for 2 or 3 days, but then it passes because they move on. I didn't tag anyone in it or anything. I didn't hashtag it even. That's the funny thing about this world. I mean, she has obviously this huge fandom online, and they're very ardent, and they are very loyal. And when she's being attacked, when they feel that she's being attacked, they rush in to defend her. And even if it's a relatively small thing like my piece, and we didn't really, I didn't tag anyone in it. They found it. You know, they're looking for that.
They stuff. Have Google alerts set up,
right? They have alerts, and then they descended swiftly. I'll show you the video. Last week at Club Cumming, I did a thing where I responded to it.
Knock it off.
I read some of the texts that they had sent me, and I did a ballad version of Shake It Off. Of Taylor Swift's Shake It Off.
I love you.
I'll send you the video.
I love you. Yes,
I want to post it. I kind of want to post it, but then it's sort of, that is kind of inviting another wave of Swiftie violence, and I don't know if I want to go there.
Swiftie violence.
But that is, you know, social media does change that equation. When you write especially negative things, there will often be people who are angry with you, and sometimes vocally so. I think most artists don't respond themselves in that way because it makes them look defensive. I mean, I understand why they would be defensive.
They'd be responding to 3 million comments.
Well, I mean, it's tricky. You know, you get a lot more immediate feedback these days than you used to. People have to sit down and write a letter to the editor and put it in.
Well, we'll be giving out your home address at the end of this as a tag.
My life is an open book.
I also wanted to ask you that. In the world of social media, and everybody gets to be a theater critic by buying a ticket to the theater, going and saying something about it.
Or a restaurant reviewer or whatever. Yeah.
Well, there's always been word of mouth. It's just now it's more public. That's happening in a more public way. The problem with Yelp or with ShowScore or any of these sort of crowdsourced reviews, is that you don't know what you're getting. You don't know if the people who are doing them are reliable. You don't know if they are independent. You also, because of the nature of the beast, especially in the theater community, there's a pressure to be publicly positive about things. So you'll end up in a situation where if people don't like things, they just won't say anything. And if they do like it, they will. And it can lead to a skewed impression of what is out there. Also, a lot of people don't have my taste. And I don't mean my superior taste. I just mean they don't share my taste. Like, if I wanted to know what was good for me, I would not necessarily just go to a crowd of people on the street and say, what should I do? Mm-hmm. You know?
Right. Go to the Red Stairs like, and I will ask go to, which I
will,
show
no,
I should
I will
see.
Go to a trusted friend and I will say, like, oh, what should I watch on TV right now? Have you been watching anything you like? I will not just go on the street and say, hey, everybody, what's on TV?
What you watching?
Because I don't know who those people are. And I don't know if I can value their taste.
I'd love to see you do that, though, now that I visualize it. Right. So clearly.
Right. But I like to know who I'm, whom I'm dealing with when I'm getting opinions about things. And one thing that's nice with critics is that over a period of time, if you read them, you can get a sense of whether you trust their taste. And
a crossword puzzle author. You get a sense of their clues.
Right. Exactly. You slowly start to get an understanding. And then sometimes you can gauge it. You can say, well, Adam didn't like this, but maybe I will. Basically, I know that he doesn't like this kind of musical. You know, For example, I gave a kind of like mixed-y review to Ain't Too Proud, even though I know that a lot of people will love that show. And I shouted out the things that I thought were great about it. There's great songs in it. The cast is amazing. You know, and then I also mentioned the problems that I had with some of the storytelling. For a lot of people reading that, they won't care about the storytelling because they don't. That's not really why they're seeing the show, which is fine. You know, there's a lot to enjoy in that show, and people are enjoying it. And I don't begrudge them enjoying that show. It's just that when I was weighing it out, that mattered to me. And I think that part of my job is to try to have higher standards than the average person, because I'm writing for people who care about higher standards. There's a lot that goes into the decision of whether you're going to go to the theater. You know, who's in it, and what did my mother say about it, and what's the ad campaign, and how much
does
it cost?
Where am I putting my money? I have this much money to see a show.
Is it a limited run? Is it a company that I've seen before? Is it writers that I liked before? You know, there's a million of those factors that are going to be entering into the decision-making pie.
Am I here for a week, and I only can see two shows?
Right.
And then I'm back in Nebraska.
Right. And so critics fill a little slice of that pie, which is, like, is it quote-unquote good? You know? And it's meant for the people who read critics. A lot of people won't and don't, and that's fine. And the people who do read us, I think, are hoping for someone to take it a little bit more seriously. Mm-hmm. And so we do. We do take it more seriously. And sometimes I'll write a review and people will be like, oh, come on, it's just a fun show. And I'm like, so fine, so see it. See it anyway. I don't care. It's your money.
Yeah.
It's your life.
Sure.
But I'm writing for the type of person for whom that question...
They're handheld a little bit.
Yeah. Well, who want a little guide and who want... I mean, I see everything, and I see everything for free. But most people don't have that luxury. And I... if people have limited time and resources, I would rather try to direct them to the things that I think are the most exciting, the most beautiful, the most pleasurable, and try to guide them away from things that I think will not be the best use of their time. That's all. That's all I'm trying to do.
Well done.
We lost a very well-known critic today, yes, John Simon.
Yeah, speaking of negative reviews.
We can obviously cut this part. I didn't know if he was a critic that you tended to.
Well, no, I knew John for many years. Among other things, I've been the president of the New York Drama Critics Circle for the past 14 years. And so I've gotten to know my fellow critics quite well over that time, many of them, at least professionally. And it was interesting to meet John because, you know, I had read a lot of his stuff before. And he was famously cruel in his reviews. And, you know, that cruelty is interesting now. I mean, everyone always knew that he was really mean.
Did it come with humor at all?
Yes. No, yeah, it was often very funny. It was often sort of guilty pleasure funny. It was really mean. He would be very cutting about the way that people looked, especially women. He was often, by today's standards, but I was going to say by today's standards, but actually by any standard, was at his heyday, and he was at New York Magazine for 40 years. He was often very sexist, very openly homophobic, racist, lookist. So, you know, a lot of...
Presidential.
Right. A lot of things. But, you know, you'd read these, and because he was also an extraordinarily gifted writer, there was a panache to these insults. It wasn't just, you know, some guy screaming obscenities on the street. He was a very erudite, a very well-read, very broadly... what's the word I'm looking for? But he had a broad exposure to multiple art forms, and he was very imperious in his opinions. It seemed to be coming from this place of Olympian good taste, and at least that was the attitude that it projected. I think that ultimately, when you look back on these reviews, what you find is that the taste wasn't actually always there. The things that he liked haven't necessarily stood up, and the things that he hated, many of them have stood up very well. What stands out in the writing is the quality of the writing, which was extraordinarily good. He came to English as a second language. He was from Serbia, and he had that he had that extraordinary ability that you sometimes find with people who come to English as a second language who are brilliant, and who come to English as a second language, people like Tom Stoppard or, you know... people who are alert to language, we were talking about this before, but who have learned English and know its rules and care about those rules and also are alert to the opportunities that the language presents, the enormous richness of the vocabulary and the slight distinctions among different kinds of words, you know? And a certain kind of person, a Stoppard, a Nabokov, you know, will take that to new places. And John, in many ways, was such a writer. He used language extremely well. He wrote a language column for Esquire for a while, which was also very mean and very dismissive of people who wrote in ways that were not to his standards. All of that said, as entertaining in a mean way as it can be to read these reviews, and you often just read them and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe he said that. And that is funny. And the images that he creates are original and writerly and funny. They're also horrible a lot of the time, you know? They're also
can't wait
just,
to read one.
They're really mean. He just died. I'm not going to spit on his grave today, but he leaves a complicated legacy because he's the kind of critic. He's the kind of critic that people think critics are in the movies. You know, this kind of snobby, mean sadist. And in fact, there are I don't know any critic like that except John Simon. And that's not me mischaracterizing him. He liked being that. He enjoyed playing that role He did it. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was very provocative. He considered it his responsibility to uphold these standards that he thought were important. That included aesthetic standards. He thought that was part of the beauty of what you see on stage. It's part of why you go to the theater, is to see beautiful people. And people who were not beautiful were disappointing to him in that regard. And that's what he believed, you know, and his writing was consistent with that belief. And he enjoyed courting that kind of controversy. I don't think that there is anyone who writes that way anymore. I've written my share of very mean reviews, but I do my best, and I know that those reviews will be hurtful to the people who worked on them. There's no way to avoid that. But also, yes, sometimes you do want to write a slash and burn review. People like reading them. And also, you need it because you need to have a range of responses in your larger body of work. If you just write Breathless and Comia about everything, how great everything is, then people
they lose can't trust. It properly.
Yeah,
no, listen,
yeah,
some people don't touch McDonald's. Some people, that's their last meal before they die, and they want it that way.
Yeah, that's fine. And if I were a restaurant critic evaluating the quality of McDonald's burger, I would have to say that it's a bad burger. That is not the same as saying people won't enjoy eating
it. It's consistent.
Also, people, you know, that particular brand is drummed into us as children in this way that creates a deep sentimental attachment to it.
Sure.
But, I mean, I've written my share of funny, mean reviews. People do read them as guilty pleasures. They get a lot of response. I get a lot of positive response for those. People won't say so online because they don't want to appear like they are beating up on people.
Interesting.
But I will get a lot of private messages saying, oh, thank you for saying that.
You mentioned on the panel that, you know, it's part of the job, and the theater makers know that reviews are part of the gig. And
yes, it is. And most of them, most of the time, look, there are different kinds of bad shows and there are different kinds of bad reviews. I think nowadays I will certainly try to aim my fire at shows that are big targets, at shows that are expensive, at shows that I think are cynically conceived. If people are trying to make something great and they're just not quite getting there, I'm not gonna write a mean review about that. I will note that it is not for me successful, and that will be hurtful enough to the people involved. The meaner ones you reserve for things that offend you in some way, and there are shows that offend me for various reasons, and so I will go harder on those. But also, ultimately, in as much as the artist's feelings are concerned, it is something I wrestle with all the time because I consider myself part of the theater community.
You're in the world.
I am in that world, and I have friends who are making theater and who are trying. I see how difficult it is for them. Even just performing it has given me a lot more insight into the various things that are going on in the course of even just a singing performance. So I think that's made me a better critic, and I think it's certainly made me less slash and burny in my inclinations than I was. Maybe also I'm just getting older, and I don't get off on being mean anymore. I see the effects of it a little bit more. But ultimately, the review isn't for the artist. I'm not their dramaturg. I'm not their, I'm not their producer. I'm not their director. I'm not their friend. I'm writing it for the audience. I'm a surrogate to some extent for a certain part of the audience. And if the artists want to read it, they are eavesdropping on that conversation. And I know that a lot of them do. Some of them don't ever read reviews. Some of them do and say they don't. Some of them do. And I know that their feelings will be hurt, as mine are when people say mean things about me, especially if, in a weird way, especially if there's some truth to it. It's worse, you know. No, it's
sure. Yeah. It's how you
so, like, for example, last weekend I was besieged by Taylor Swift fans, but they're all saying the same things, you know. And I know it's not really about me. It's not about what I wrote. There was not a single thing that actually addressed what all the problems that I had with the song. It was just like, you're ugly and I have a stupid mustache.
It's beautiful.
Thank you. But you know, but on that level, like that, you can really just it really does slide off of you. And sometimes there will be things. It will be like, this reflects your, you know, blind spot in this way or another, that was cruel or that was, and those things I will respond to more. Anyway, that's, but the point is, I know these things can be hurtful, but it is important to the function of what I'm doing and what other critics are doing that we be honest and that we not just be another wing of the publicity arm.
Yeah, people want that. People want the honesty.
Right. And again, there will be a lot of other sources of information. There will be advertising telling you how great it is. There will be people on TV, you know, performing songs from it and talking about how great it is. And there will be a lot of people selling you the show all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't, I'm happy if I love a show. I'm happy if things that I say are useful to the show because I want more people to see it. I'm happy if they use it in advertising. But I don't work for the advertisers.
Mm-hmm. But enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of me?
What was your first impression of each of us?
I loved both of you at first sight.
Good answer.
Yeah.
Well, truly, I don't know if you remember when we first met, but it was maybe 2012 at the Duplex upstairs, probably on a Saturday night when I was dating Poppy Kramer. Mm.
Dear departed Poppy Kramer.
Dear departed Poppy Kramer. But that's, I believe, you know, and she was really good at, while she was bartending and holding court, she'd be like, oh, you need to meet this person over at the other end of the bar. You know, mm-hmm. she wasn't like totally gabbing all the time. She's like, oh, you need to meet these people. And so I met a lot of people that way. Mm-hmm. And one of them was you. And it was a very long time ago, and I feel like that's when you were singing at the Duplex as well. There was Suddenly Sondheim or whatever it was called.
Mostly Sondheim.
Mostly Sondheim. Suddenly Sondheim. So that's when I met you, and I just was like, Harvard, tell me everything. Tell me everything.
Yeah,
Mr. Well, Man About Town.
Poppy's great, but that's what that's one of the things that I loved about, still love about the Duplex, and and certainly one of the things, as I said before, that I love about Club Cumming is you really, if you put in the time, you really do get a sense of being part of a little community of people who love doing the things that they're doing.
And we were both on the cover of Time Out, right next to each other.
I don't remember that. I don't even remember being on the cover.
It was, remember when they did all those Polaroids? It was the queer...
It was a queer issue.
Queer issue, and there was like... I don't know, 35 people on the cover in little Polaroids.
Yeah.
And then Adam Feldman and I were on the bottom.
Oh, per usual.
Per usual.
That's right.
Anyway, that's just a little nugget.
I was looking at Dana.
Hi-ho! Hi-ho! Hi-ho!
Question number two.
Yeah.
There are seven very well-known dwarves in history. If you were the eighth dwarf, what would your name be?
Hmm. Oh man, I should have a witty reply for this at the ready. Testy.
Testy. Sick.
I don't know if that's exactly right. I don't feel very testy today. I'm feeling mellower and mellower the older I get.
What if we've had, you know, Belty, Skrelty, Slutty, Margaret.
Yeah, Margaret.
We've had many.
Margaret the Dwarf.
Yeah. Wordy.
Wordy. Well, yeah, Wordy is, I mean, obviously, Wordy is probably a good one for me. I mean, can I switch to Wordy? Seems nicer than Testy. Testy makes me sound like a jerk.
Or just
touchy.
I'm thinking about all these Y words, but I could be Dogger Bashful. That's true.
Yeah, Dogger Bashful.
Do whatever you want.
Man.
This is going to torture you more than anyone else we've had. Yeah,
Shorty? I just think there's like a meta quality of being Shorty the Dwarf. That would be...
Shorty Dwarf?
Yeah. Like, I sort of like the on-the-noseness of it. Like, it wouldn't... I don't know.
Like Will Shorts?
Or tall. I would be tall for a dwarf.
Tall dwarf?
Hey, have you guys seen Tall? And it's also kind of Jewish.
Yeah, Tall. Yeah. T-A-L. God, I may ask you.
Glad we can workshop this.
Yeah, we have to workshop this out.
Tall dwarf with one L. It's really good.
I'll get back to you on that.
Where can people find you? We gave your email up top. Would you like to give it again?
Well, that's for people to write me an email, but I would probably prefer it if people did it in public, unless they were sending me a pitch for a show or a pitch for their writing. But you can find me on social media. I'm on Twitter, where my handle is Feldman Adam, which is my name except with my last name first. Because some jerk in Michigan got my name.
Probably a lot of Adam Feldman.
Yeah, there's like eight of us in New York.
Yeah.
And I'm on Instagram, which I don't use very much, but I'm A.D. Feldman there, and I'm on Facebook.
And at Club Coming on Mondays.
And I'm at Club Coming every Monday night, y'all.
You're the best.
Thank you so much for spending part of your coveted Club Coming evening
It doesn't start until like...
He's got an equity cot moment.
It's a delight to talk with you all. Thank you all for having me on the show.
Thanks for the suncast.
My pleasure. It's nice to find a kindred spirit.
I'll always share a six pack with you. On that note, bye.
Bye.
In the Room with Stephen and Dana is produced by Stephen Farazi
and Dana Craig. Special thanks to Joel Wagoner for tinkling the ivories on our theme song. Hit him up at joelwagoner.com.
We apologize, and you're welcome. We'd also like to thank Jesse Wiener, W-I-E-N-E-R, for our jazzy original music sprinkled throughout each episode.
You can find him at jessewiener.com.
Last but certainly not least, we'd like to thank Kevin Thomas Garcia for taking all of our ridiculous photos. You can find him online at ktgnyc.com. We are all over the internet on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at In The Room Pod.
Follow us, like us, share us, pimp us out. And don't forget to subscribe to In The Room Podcast. We everywhere, so subscribe. And thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.